I envisioned myself burning on a pyre of dream sequences, and then the answer came to me. "Who am I?" I asked. "I am the only one who is paid to be in this room. The rest of you are all paying." This was nothing I'd necessarily want to embroider on a pillow, but still, once the answer left my mouth, I embraced it as a perfectly acceptable teaching philosophy. My previous doubts and fears evaporated, as now I knew that I could excuse anything. The new Mr. Sedaris would never again back down or apologize. From here on out, I'd order my students to open and close the door, and let that remind me that I was in charge. We could do whatever I wanted to because I was a certified professional. It practically said so right there on my paycheck. My voice deepened as I stood to straighten my tie. "All right, then," I said. "Does anyone else have a stupid question for Mr. Sedaris?" The returning student once again raised her hand. "It's a personal question, I know, but exactly how much is the school paying you to be in this room?" I answered honestly, and then, for the first time since the beginning of the school year, my students came together as one. I can't recall which side started it. I remember only that the laughter was so loud, so violent and prolonged, that Mr. Sedaris had to run and close the door so that the real teachers could conduct their business in peace. Today's special. It is his birthday, and Hugh and I are seated in a New York restaurant, awaiting the arrival of our 15-word entrees. Hugh looks very nice, dressed in a suit and sweater that have always belonged to him. As for me, I own only my shoes, pants, shirt, and tie. My jacket belongs to the restaurant and was offered as a loan by the maitre d', who apparently thought I would feel more comfortable dressed to lead a high school marching band. I'm worrying the thick gold braids decorating my sleeves when the waiter presents us with what he calls a little something to amuse the palate. Roughly the size and color of a Band-Aid, the amusement floats on a shallow, muddy puddle of sauce and is topped with a sprig of greenery. "And this would be what exactly?" Hugh asks. "This," the waiter announces, "is our raw Atlantic swordfish served in a dark chocolate gravy and garnished with fresh mint." "Not again," I say. "Can't you guys come up with something a little less conventional?" "Love your jacket," the waiter whispers. As a rule, I'm no great fan of eating out in New York restaurants. It's hard to love a place that's outlawed smoking but finds it perfectly acceptable to serve raw fish in a bath of chocolate. There are no normal restaurants left, at least in our neighborhood. The diners have all been taken over by precious little bistros boasting a menu of indigenous American cuisine. They call these meals traditional, yet they're rarely the American dishes I remember. The patty melt has been pushed aside in favor of the herb-encrusted medallions of baby artichoke hearts, which never leave me thinking, "Oh right, those. I wonder if they're as good as the ones my mom used to make." Part of the problem is that we live in the wrong part of town. Soho is not a macaroni salad kind of a place. This is where the world's brightest young talents come to braise caramelized racks of corn-fed songbirds, or offer up their famous knuckle of flash-seared crappie, served with a collar of chida ginger and cornered by a tribe of kiln-roasted Chilean toadstools, teased with a warm spray of clarified musk oil. Even when they promise something simple, they've got to tart it up. The meatloaf has been poached in seawater, or there are figs in the tuna salad. If cooking is an art, I think we're in our Dada phase. I never thought of myself as a particularly finicky eater, but it's hard to be a good sport when each dish seems to include no fewer than a dozen ingredients, one of which I'm bound to dislike. I'd order the skirt steak with a medley of suffocated peaches, but I'm put off by the aspirin sauce. The sea scallops look good until I'm told they're served in a broth of malt liquor and mummified lychee nuts. What I really want is a cigarette, and I'm always searching the menu in hope that some courageous young chef has finally recognized tobacco as a vegetable. Bake it, steam it, grill it, or stuff it into little neck clams. I just need something familiar that I can hold on to. When the waiter brings our entrees, I have no idea which plate might be mine. In yesterday's restaurants, it was possible both to visualize and recognize your meal. There were always subtle differences, but for the most part, a lamb chop tended to maintain its basic shape. That is to say that it looked chop-like. It had a handle made of bone and a teardrop of meat hugged by a thin rind of fat. Apparently, though, that was too predictable. Order the modern lamb chop, and it's likely to look no different than your companion's order of shackled pompano. The current food is always arranged into a senseless vertical tower. No longer content to recline, it now reaches for the sky, much like the high-rise buildings lining our city streets. It's as if the plates were valuable parcels of land and the chef had purchased one small lot along with unlimited air rights. Hugh's saffron linguine resembles a miniature turban topped with architectural spires of shrimp. It stands there in the center while the rest of the vast empty plate looks as though it's been leased out as a possible parking lot. I had ordered the steak, which, bowing to the same minimalist fashion, is served without the bone, the thin slices of beef stacked to resemble a funeral pyre. The potatoes I'd been expecting have apparently either been clarified to an essence or were used to stoke the grill. Maybe, Hugh says, maybe they're inside your tower of meat. This is what we have been reduced to. Hugh blows the yucca pollen off his blackened shrimp while I push back the sleeves of my borrowed sports coat and search the meat tower for my promised potatoes. There they are, right there. Hugh uses his fork to point out what could easily be mistaken for 5 cavity-ridden molars. The dark spots must be my vegetable. Because I am both a glutton and a masochist, my standard complaint, "That was so bad," is always followed by, "And there was so little of it." Our plates are cleared and we are presented with dessert menus. I learn that spiced ham is no longer considered just a luncheon meat, and that even back issues of Smithsonian can be turned into sorbets. "I just couldn't," I say to the waiter when he recommends the white chocolate and wild loganberry couscous. "If we're counting calories, I could have the chef serve it without the creme fraiche," he says. "No," I say, "really, I just couldn't." We ask for the check, explaining that we have a movie to catch. It's only a 10-minute walk to the theater, but I'm antsy because I'd like to get something to eat before the show. They'll have loads of food at the concession stand, but I don't believe in mixing meat with my movies. Luckily, there's a hot dog cart not too far out of our way. Friends always say, "How can you eat those? I read in the paper that they're made from hog's lips." And hearts and eyelids. That, to my mind, is only 3 ingredients and constitutes a refreshing change of pace. I order mine with nothing but mustard, and I'm thrilled to watch the vendor present my hot dog in a horizontal position. So simple and timeless that I can recognize it immediately as food. City of Angels. My childhood friend Alicia lives in North Carolina, but used to visit me in New York at least twice a year. She was always an easy, undemanding house guest, and it was a pleasure having her, as she was happy following me around on errands or just lying on my sofa, reading a magazine. "Just pretend I'm not here," she'd say, and I sometimes did. Quiet and willing to do whatever anyone else wanted, she was often favorably compared to a shadow. A week before one of her regular December visits, Alicia called to say she'd be bringing along a guest, someone named Bonnie. The woman worked at a sandwich shop and had never traveled more than 50 miles from her home in Greensboro. Alicia hadn't known her long, but said that she seemed like a very sweet person. That's one of Alicia's most well-worn adjectives, sweet, and she uses it to describe just about everyone. Were you to kick her in the stomach, the most you would expect would be a demotion to semi-sweet. I've never known anyone so willing to withhold judgment and overlook what often strike me as major personality defects. Like all of my friends, she's a lousy judge of character. The two women arrived in New York on a Friday afternoon, and upon greeting them, I noticed an uncommon expression on Alicia's face. It was a look of someone who's discovered too late that she's either set her house on fire or committed herself to traveling with the wrong person. "Run for your life," she whispered. Bonnie was a dour, spindly woman whose thick, girlish braids fell like leashes over the innocent puppies pictured on her sweatshirt. She had a pronounced Greensboro accent and had landed at Kennedy convinced that, given half a chance, the people of New York would steal the fillings right out of her mouth. And she was not about to let that happen. The cab driver said, "It sounds to me like you two ladies are from out of town," and I knew right then that he was planning to rip us off. Alicia placed her head in her hands, massaging what had become a visible headache. I knew exactly what he was up to. I know the rules. I'm not stupid, so I wrote down his name and his license number and said I'd report him to the police if he tried any funny business. I didn't come all this way to be robbed blind, and I told him that, didn't I, Alicia? She showed me the taxi receipt, and I verified that this was indeed the correct price. It's a standard $30 fare from Kennedy Airport to any destination in Manhattan. She stuffed the receipt back into her wallet. "Well, I hope he wasn't expecting a tip, 'cause he didn't get a dime out of me."
"You didn't tip him?"
"Hell no," Bonnie said. "I don't know about you, but I work hard for my money. It's mine, and I am not tipping anyone unless they give me the kind of service I expect."
"Fine," I said, "but what kind of service did you expect if you've never before ridden in a cab?"
"I expect to be treated just like everybody else is what I expect. I expect to be treated like an American."
That was the root of the problem right there. Visiting Americans will find more warmth in Tehran than they will in New York, a city founded on the principle of us versus them. I don't speak Latin, but have always assumed that the city motto translates to either "go home" or "we don't like you either." Like me, most of the people I knew had moved to New York with the express purpose of escaping Americans such as Bonnie. Fear had worked in our favor until a new mayor began promoting the city as a family theme park. His campaign had worked, and now the Bonnies were arriving in droves, demanding the same hospitality they'd received last month in Orlando. I've had visitors from all over, but Alicia's friend was the first to arrive with an itinerary, a thick bundle of brochures and schedules she kept in a nylon pouch strapped around her waist. Before leaving North Carolina, she'd spoken to a travel agent, who'd provided her with a list of destinations anyone in her right mind would know to avoid, especially around the holidays, when the crowds multiplied to Chinese proportions. "Well," I said, "we'll see what we can do. I'm sure Alicia has places she'd like to go too, so maybe we can just take turns." The expression on her face suggested that give and take was a new and unpleasant concept to Bonnie of Greensboro. Her jaw tightened, and she turned back to her brochures, muttering, "I came to New York to see New York, and isn't anybody going to stop me?" Our troubles began the following morning when I disregarded the itinerary and took the two women to the Chelsea flea market. Alicia wanted to look for records and autographs. Bonnie wasn't much of a shopper, but after a pronounced bout of whining, she decided she wouldn't mind adding to her lifelong angel collection. "Angels," she said, "were God's way of saying, howdy." The flea market was good for records and autographs, but none of the angels mustered an appropriate howdy.
"Not at these prices. I asked some lady how much she wanted for a little glass angel holding a trumpet, and when she said it cost $45, I told her to go straight to you know where. I said there's no way I'm paying that much when back home I can get 10 angels for that price. And I said they'd be a lot more spiritual than the sorry-looking New York angels y'all have here. That's exactly what I told her."
She pronounced the flea market a complete waste of time, adding that she was cold and hungry and ready to leave. It was decided that even though $1.50 was a lot to charge for a 10-minute ride, we would take the subway uptown and get something to eat. Things went smoothly until the transit clerk accidentally shorted her a nickel, and Bonnie stuck her mouth into the token booth, shouting,
"Excuse me, but for your information, I do not appreciate being taken for a fool. I may be from Greensboro, North Carolina, but I can count just as well as anyone else. Now, are you going to give me my 5 cents, or should I talk to your supervisor?"
At the restaurant, she insisted that the waitress had overcharged her for her milkshake, though the price was right there on the menu. When I suggested we leave and maybe see a movie, Bonnie pushed herself back from the table and proceeded to sulk.
I wanted to go to a Broadway show, and here y'all are talking about a movie I could see back home for $3.50. I flew 500 miles to see New York, and all I got was a chocolate milkshake and a plate of hash browns. Some damn trip this turned out to be.
We should have beaten her to death. It was clearly the best solution to the problem, but instead we went to the half-price ticket booth. Alicia took her monster to a Broadway show, and I met up with them afterwards. We hoped the play might satisfy Bonnie, but once she'd gotten a taste of her itinerary, there was no stopping her. The following morning, she woke Alicia at 7 a.m. so that they could get a head start on the Statue of Liberty in the Empire State Building. They visited the UN in the South Street Seaport and returned to my apartment at 4 in the afternoon. Alicia was ready to throw in the towel, but Bonnie wanted to go for high tea at the Plaza Hotel. High tea is fine if you like that kind of thing, but she became angry when I suggested that she might first want to change into something more appropriate. The woman was wearing what people in the South refer to as hog washers, the sort of denim overalls favored by farmers. The crowd at the plaza would likely be dressed up, and I worried that she might feel out of place in an outfit most people associate with hard manual labor. I was only trying to help, but Bonnie didn't see it that way.
Let me tell you something, Mr. New York City. I am very comfortable with the way I look, and if the Plaza Hotel doesn't like what I'm wearing, then that's their problem, not mine.
I done my best to warn her, but was actually thrilled when she rejected my advice. The scarecrow look was fine by me. I'd never been to the plaza, but felt certain she'd be eaten alive by troops of wealthy, over-caffeinated society women with high standards and excellent aim. Service would be denied, voices would be raised, and she'd wind up drinking her tea at a pancake restaurant in Midtown. Alicia changed into a dress and I dropped them off at the hotel, returning an hour later to find Bonnie wandering the tea room with her disposable camera.
Would y'all mind taking a picture of me standing next to the waiter? I'd have my friend do it, but she's got a bug up her butt.
I expected her to be physically removed from the building and was horrified to realize that the Plaza Hotel was essentially Bonnie Central. Dressed for comfort in sweatshirts and tracksuits, her fellow scarecrows were more than happy to accommodate her. The flashbulbs were blinding.
"Now those were some nice New Yorkers," she said, waving goodbye to the crowd in the tea room.
I tried to explain to her that they weren't real New Yorkers, but at that point she'd stopped listening to anything I had to say. She dragged Alicia off for a carriage ride through Central Park, and then it was time for a visit to what she called Foul Schwartz. The toy store was followed by a brutal pilgrimage to Radio City Music Hall, St. Patrick's Cathedral, and the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Plaza. The crowds were such that you could pick your feet off the ground and be carried for blocks in either direction. I was mortified, but Bonnie was in a state of almost narcotic bliss, overjoyed to have discovered a New York without the New Yorkers. Here were the out-of-town visitors from Omaha and Chattanooga, outraged over the price of their hot-roasted chestnuts. They apologized when stepping on someone's foot and never thought to complain when some nitwit with a video camera stupidly blocked their path. The crowd was relentlessly, pathologically friendly, and their enthusiasm was deafening. Looking around her, Bonnie saw a glittering paradise filled with decent, like-minded people, sent by God to give the world a howdy. Encircled by her army of angels, she drifted across the avenue to photograph a juggler, while I hobbled off towards home, a clear outsider in a city I'd foolishly thought to call my own. A Shiner Like a Diamond. I'd been living in Manhattan for 8 years when my father called, excited by the news that my sister Amy was scheduled to appear in a magazine article devoted to the subject of interesting New York women.
"Can you imagine?" he asked. "My God, put a camera in front of that girl and she'll shine like a diamond. Between the single men and the job opportunities, her phone is going to be ringing right off the hook."
He paused for a moment, perhaps imagining the life of a young New York woman whose phone rings off the hook.
"We just have to make sure that none of the wrong people call her. You'll take care of that, right?" I'm putting it on my to-do list as we speak. Good boy, he said. The trouble is that she's just so darn pretty. That's a danger right there. Plus, you know, she's a girl.
My father has always placed a great deal of importance on his daughter's physical beauty. It is, to him, their greatest asset, and he monitors their appearance with the intensity of a pimp. What can I say? He was born a long time ago, and is convinced that marriage is a woman's only real shot at happiness. Because it was always assumed that we would lead professional lives, my brother and I were free to grow as plump and ugly as we liked. Our bodies were viewed as mere vehicles, pasty, pot-bellied machines designed to transport our thoughts from one place to the next. I might wander freely through the house, drinking pancake batter from a plastic bucket, but the moment one of my sisters overspilled her bikini, my father was right there to mix his metaphors.
Jesus, Flossie, what are we running here, a dairy farm? Look at you, you're the size of a house. 2 more pounds and you won't be able to cross state lines without a trucking license.
Oh, Lou, my mother would moan. For Christ's sakes, give it a rest.
Aw, baloney, they'll thank me for this later.
He honestly thought that he was doing his girls a favor, and it confused him when the thanks never came. In response to his vigilance and pressure, my sisters grew increasingly defensive and self-conscious. The sole exception turned out to be Amy, who was capable of getting even without first getting mad. Nothing seems to stick to her, partly because she's so rarely herself. Her fondness for transformation began at an early age and has developed into something closely resembling a multiple personality disorder. She's Sybil with a better sense of humor, Eve without the crying jags. "And who are we today?" my mother used to ask, leading to Amy's, "Who don't you want me to be?" At the age of 10, Amy was caught taking a fistful of 20s from an unguarded till at the grocery store. I was with her and marveled at my sister's deftness and complete lack of fear. When the manager was called, she calmly explained that she wasn't stealing. She was simply pretending to be a thief. "And thieves steal," she said. "So that's what I was doing." It all made perfect sense to her. She failed first grade by pretending to be stupid, but the setback didn't seem to bother her. For Amy, school was devoted solely to the study of her teachers. She meticulously charted the repetition of their shoes and earrings and was quick to pinpoint their mannerisms. After school, alone in her simulated classroom, she would talk like them, dress like them, and assign herself homework she would never complete. She became a Girl Scout only to become her Girl Scout leader. For Christmases and birthdays, she requested wigs and makeup, hospital gowns and uniforms. Amy became my mother, and then my mother's friends. She was great as Suze Grossman and Eleanor Kelleher, but her best impersonation was of Penny Midland, a stylish 50-year-old woman who worked part-time in an art gallery my parents used to visit on a regular basis. Penny's voice was deep and roughly textured. She wasn't shy, but when she spoke, certain words tended to leave her mouth reluctantly, as if they'd been forced out against their will. Dressed in a caftan and an appropriate white pageboy wig, Amy began phoning my father at the office.
"Lou Sedaris? Penny Midland here. How the hell are you?"
Surprised that this woman would be calling him at work, our father feigned enthusiasm as best he could.
"Penny! Well, what do you know? Gosh, it's good to hear your voice."
The first few times she called, Amy discussed gallery business, but little by little began complaining about her husband, a Westinghouse executive named Van. There were problems at home. Her marriage, it seemed, was on the rocks. Our father offered comfort with the standard noncommittal phrases, reminding Penny that there were two sides to every coin, and that it's always darkest before the dawn.
"Oh, Lou, it just feels so good to talk to someone who really understands."
I walked into the kitchen late one afternoon and came upon my 12-year-old sister propositioning our father with lines she had collected from Guiding Light.
"I think we've both seen this coming for a long time, Lou. The only question left is, what are we going to do about it? Oh, baby, let's run wild.
This is what my mother meant when she accused people of playing a dangerous game. Were our father to accept Penny's offer, Amy would have known him as a philanderer and wondered who else he might have slept with. Everything he'd ever said would be shaded by doubt and called into question. Was that really a business trip, or had he snuck off to Myrtle Beach with one of the Stravides twins? Who was this man? Amy studied her reflection in the oven door, arranging her white bangs and liking what she saw.
All I'm saying is that I find you to be a very attractive man, Lou. Is that such a crime?
It is to his credit that our father was such a gentleman. Stammering that he was very flattered to be asked, he let Penny down as gently as possible. After offering to set her up with some available bachelors from his office and country club, he told my sister to take care of herself, adding that she was a very special woman who deserved to be happy. It was years before Amy finally admitted what she had done. They were relatively uneventful years for our family, but, I imagine, a very confusing period of time for poor Penny Midland, who was frequently visited at the art gallery by my father and any number of his divorced associates. "Here's that gal I was telling you about," he'd say. "Why don't I just take a look around and give you two a chance to talk?" The passage of time has not altered my father's obsessive attention to my sister's weight and appearance. He wonders why the girls don't drop by more often, and then, when they do, he opens the door asking, "Is it just my imagination, or have you put on a few pounds?" Because she has maintained her beautiful skin and enviable figure, Amy remains my father's greatest treasure. She is by far the most attractive member of the family, yet she spends most of her time and money disguising herself beneath prosthetic humps and appliqued skin diseases. She's got more neck braces and false teeth than she knows what to do with, and her drawers and closets overflow with human hair. Having dreamt of one for years, she finally broke down and bought half of a padded, custom-made fatty suit she enjoys wearing beneath dirty sweatpants as tight and uninviting as sausage casings. Unable to afford the suit's matching top, she has been reduced to waddling the streets much like two women fused together in some sort of a cruel experiment. From the waist up, she's slim and fit, chugging forward on legs the size of tree trunks and followed by a wide, dimpled bottom so thick she could sit on a knitting needle and never feel a thing. She wore the fatty suit home one Christmas and our father, visibly shaken, met us at the Raleigh airport. He managed to say nothing on the short ride to the house, but the moment Amy stepped into the bathroom, he turned to me, shouting, "What the hell happened to her? Christ almighty, this is killing me. I'm in real pain here."
"What?"
"Your sister, that's what. I just saw her 6 months ago, and now the girl's the size of a tank. I thought you were supposed to be keeping an eye on her."
I begged him to lower his voice.
"Please, Dad, don't mention it in front of Amy. She's very sensitive about her, you know."
"Her what? Go ahead and say it. Her big fat ass. That's what she's ashamed of, and she should be. Christ almighty, you could land a chopper on an ass like that."
"Oh, Dad, don't try to defend her, wise guy. She's a single woman and the clock is ticking away. Who's gonna love her? Who's gonna marry her with an ass like that?"
"Well," I said, "from what I've been told, a lot of men prefer rear ends like that."
He looked at me with great pity, his heart breaking for the second time that day.
"Man, what you don't know could fill a book."
My father composed himself when Amy re-entered the room, but when she turned to open the refrigerator door, he acted as though she were tossing a lit match into the gas tank of his Porsche.
"What in God's name are you doing? Look at you, you're killing yourself."
Amy stuck a tablespoon into an economy-sized vat of mayonnaise.
"Your problem is that you're bored," my father said. "You're bored and lonely, and you're eating garbage to fill the void. I know what you're going through, but believe me, we can beat this."
Amy denied that she was bored and lonely. The problem, she said, was that she was hungry. All I had on the plane were a couple of Danish. Can we go out for pancakes? She kept it up until our father, his voice cracking with pain, offered to find her some professional help. He mentioned camps and personal trainers, offering to loan, no, to give her the money. And on top of that, I'll pay you for every pound you take off. When Amy rejected his offer, he attempted to set an example. His Christmas dinner was gone in 3 bites, and dessert was skipped in favor of a brisk 2-mile run. Anyone want to join me? Amy? He extended his age-old exercise regime from 10 minutes to an hour, and trotted in place while speaking on the telephone. Amy kept to her fatty suit until her legs were chafed and pimpled. It was on the morning of our return flight that she finally revealed her joke, and our father wept with relief.
Ha ha, you really had me going. I should have known you'd never do that to yourself, and it's really fake. Ha!
He reflected upon the fatty suit for the next several months.
She had me fooled for a minute there, but even with a big fat ass, you can't disguise the fact that she's a beautiful person, both inside and out, and that's what really matters.
His epiphany was short-lived, and as the photo shoot approached, he began calling me with technical questions.
Do you happen to know if this magazine will be hiring a professional beautician? I sure as hell hope so, because her hair is getting awfully thin. And what are they going to do about lighting? Can we trust the photographer to do a first-class job, or should we call and see if they can't come up with someone better?
There's a lot I don't tell my father when he calls asking after Amy. He wouldn't understand that she has no interest in getting married, and was, in fact, quite happy to break up with her live-in boyfriend, whom she replaced with an imaginary boyfriend named Ricky. The last time she was asked out by a successful bachelor, Amy hesitated before saying, "Thanks for asking, but I'm really not into white guys right now." That alone would have stopped my father's heartbeat.
"The clock is ticking," he says. "If she waits much longer, she'll be alone for the rest of her life."
This appears to suit Amy just fine. When my father phoned about the photo shoot, I pretended to know nothing. I didn't tell him that, at the scheduled time, my sister arrived at the studio with unwashed hair and took a seat beside the dozen other New York women selected by the magazine. She complimented them on their flattering, carefully chosen outfits, and waited as they had their hair fashioned, their eyebrows trained, and their slight imperfections masked by powders. When it was her turn at the makeup table, Amy said, "I want to look like someone has just beaten the shit out of me." The makeup artist did a fine job. The black eyes and purple jaw were accentuated by an arrangement of scratch marks on her forehead. Paciello pools girdled her scab nose, and her swollen lips were fenced with mean rows of brackish stitches. Amy adored both the new look and the new person it allowed her to be. Following the photo shoot, she wore her bruises to the dry cleaner and grocery store. Most people nervously looked away, but on the rare occasion someone would ask what had happened, my sister smiled as brightly as possible, saying, "I'm in love. Can you believe it? I'm finally, totally in love, and I feel great." Nutcracker.com. It was my father's dream that one day the people of the world would be connected to one another through a network of blocky, refrigerator-sized computers, much like those he was helping to develop at IBM. He envisioned families of the future gathered around their mammoth terminals, ordering groceries and paying their taxes from the comfort of their own homes. A person could compose music, design a doghouse, and something more, something even better. A person could... he could... When predicting this utopia, he would eventually reach a point when words failed him. His eyes would widen and sparkle at the thought of this indescribable something more.
"I mean, my God," he'd say, "just think about it."
My sisters and I preferred not to, I didn't know about them, but I was hoping the people of the world might be united by something more interesting, like drugs or an armed struggle against the undead. Unfortunately, my father's team won, so computers it is. My only regret is that this had to happen during my lifetime. Somewhere in the back of my mind is a dim memory of standing in some line holding a perforated card. I remember the cheap, slightly clinical feeling it gave me, and I recall thinking that the computer would never advance much further than this. Call me naive, but I seem to have underestimated the universal desire to sit in a hard plastic chair and stare at a screen until your eyes cross. My father saw it coming, but this was a future that took me completely by surprise. There were no computers in my high school, and the first few times I attempted college, people were still counting on their fingers and removing their shoes when the numbers got above 10. I wasn't really aware of computers until the mid-1980s. For some reason, I seemed to know quite a few graphic designers whose homes and offices pleasantly stank of spray mount. Their floors were always collaged with stray bits of paper, and trapped flies waved for help from the gummy killing fields of their tabletops. I had always counted on these friends to loan me the adhesive of my choice, and then, seemingly overnight, their scotch tape and rubber cement were gone, replaced with odorless computers and spongy mouse pads. They had nothing left that I wanted to borrow, and so I dropped them and fell in with a group of typesetters who ultimately betrayed me as well. Thanks to my complete lack of office skills, I found it fairly easy to avoid direct contact with the new technology. The indirect contact was disturbing enough. I was living in Chicago when I began to receive creepy Christmas newsletters designed to look like tabloids and annual reports. Word processors made writing fun. They did not, however, make reading fun, a point made painfully evident by such publications as the Herald Family Tribune and What's Up with the Wexlers. Friends who had previously expressed no interest in torture began sending letters composed to resemble Chinese takeout menus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Everybody had a font, and I was told that I should get one too. The authors of these letters shared an enthusiasm with the sort of people who now arrived at dinner parties, hoisting expensive new video cameras, and suggesting that after dinner we all sit down and replay the evening on TV. We, the regular people of the world, now had access to the means of production, but still I failed to see what all the fuss was about. A dopey letter is still a dopey letter, no matter how you dress it up. And there's a reason regular people don't appear on TV. We're boring. By the early 1990s, I was living in New York and working for a house cleaning company. My job taught me that, regardless of their purported virtues, computers are a pain in the ass to keep clean. The pebbled surface is a magnet for grease and dirt, and you can pretty much forget about reaming out the gaps in the keyboard. More than once I accidentally pushed a button and recoiled in terror as a blank screen came to life with exotic tropical fish or swarms of flying toasters. Equally distressing was the way people used the slanted roofs of their terminals to display framed photographs and great populations of plush and plastic creatures, which would fall behind the desk the moment I began cleaning the screen. There was never any place to plug in the vacuum, as every outlet was occupied by some member of the computer family. Cords ran wild, and everyone seemed to own one of those ominous foot-long power strips with a blinking red light that sends a message, "You must leave us alone!" I was more than happy to comply, and the complaints came rolling in. Due to my general aversion to machines and a few pronounced episodes of screaming, I was labeled a technophobe, a word that ranks fairly low on my scale of fightin' words. The word phobic has its place when properly used, but lately it's been declawed by the pompous insistence that most animosity is based upon fear rather than good old-fashioned loathing. No credit is given for distinguishing between these two very different emotions. I fear snakes. I hate computers. My hatred is entrenched and I nourish it daily. I'm comfortable with it, and no community outreach program will change my mind. I hate computers for getting their own section in the New York Times and for lengthening commercials with mention of a website address. Who really wants to find out more about Procter & Gamble? Just buy the toothpaste or laundry detergent and get on with it. I hate them for creating the word org, and I hate them for email, which isn't real mail, but a variation of the pointless notes people used to pass in class. I hate computers for replacing the card catalog in the New York Public Library, and I hate the way they've invaded the movies. I'm not talking about their contribution to the world of special effects. I have nothing against a well-defined mutant or full-scale alien invasion. That's good technology. I'm talking about their actual presence in any given movie. They've become like horses in a Western. They may not be the main focus, but everybody seems to have one. Each tiresome new thriller includes a scene in which the hero, trapped by some version of the enemy, runs for his desk in a desperate race against time. Music swells and droplets of sweat rain down onto the keyboard as he sits at his laptop, frantically pawing for answers. It might be different if he were flagging down a passing car or trying to phone for help, but typing in and of itself is not an inherently dramatic activity. I hate computers for any number of reasons, but I despise them most for what they've done to my friend the typewriter. In a democratic country, you'd think there'd be room for both of them, but computers won't rest until I'm making my ribbons from torn shirts and brewing whiteout in my bathtub. Their goal is to place the IBM Selectric 2 beside the feather quill and chisel in the Museum of Antiquated Writing Implements. They're power-hungry, and someone needs to stop them. When told I'm like the guy still pining after his 8-track tapes, I say, "You have 8 tracks? Where?" In reality, I know nothing about them, yet I feel it's important to express some solidarity with others who have had the rug pulled out from beneath them. I don't care if I can count words or rearrange paragraphs at the push of a button. I don't want a computer. Unlike the faint scurry raised by fingers against a plastic computer keyboard, the smack and clatter of a typewriter suggests that you're actually building something. At the end of a miserable day, instead of grieving my virtual nothing, I can always look at my loaded waste paper basket and tell myself that if I failed, at least I took a few trees down with me. When forced to leave my house for an extended period of time, I take my typewriter with me, and together we endure the wretchedness of passing through the X-ray scanner. The laptops roll merrily down the belt, while I'm instructed to stand aside and open my bag. To me, it seems like a normal enough thing to be carrying, but the typewriter's declining popularity arouses suspicion, and I wind up eliciting the sort of reaction one might expect when traveling with a cannon. "It's a typewriter," I say. "You use it to write angry letters to airport authorities." The keys are then slapped and pounded, and I'm forced to explain that if you want the words to appear, you first have to plug it in and insert a sheet of paper. The goons shake their heads and tell me that I really should be using a computer. That's their job, to stand around in an ill-fitting uniform and tell you how you should lead your life. I'm told the exact same thing later that evening when the bellhop knocks on my hotel door. The people whose television I can hear have complained about my typing, and he has come to make me stop. To hear him talk, you'd think I'd been playing the kettle drum. In the great scheme of things, the typewriter is not nearly as loud as he makes it out to be, but there's no use arguing with him. "You know," he says, "you really should be using a computer." You have to wonder where you've gone wrong when twice a day you're offered writing advice from men in funny hats. The harder I'm pressured to use a computer, the harder I resist. One by one, all of my friends have deserted me and fled to the dark side. "How can I write to you if you don't have an email address?" they ask. They talk of their bee trees and disc doctors and then have the nerve to complain when I discuss bowel obstructions at the dinner table. Who needs them, I think. I figured I'd always have my family, and was devastated when my sister Amy brought home a candy-colored laptop. I only use it for email, she said. Coming from her, these words made me unbearably sad. It's fun, she said. People send you things. Look at this. She pushed a button and there, on the screen, was a naked man lying face down on a carpet. His hair was graying, and his hands were cuffed behind his doughy back. A woman entered the room. You couldn't see her face, just her legs and feet, which were big and mean-looking, forced into sharp-toed shoes with high, pencil-thin heels. The man on the carpet shifted position, and when his testicles came into view, the woman reacted as if she had seen an old balding mouse, one that she had been trying to kill for a long time. She stomped on the man's testicles with the toes of her shoes, and then she turned around and stomped on them with the heels. She kicked them mercilessly, and just when I thought she'd finished, she got her second wind and started all over again. I'd never realized that a computer could act so much like a TV set. No one had ever told me that the picture could be so clear, that the cries of pain could be heard so distinctly. This, I thought, was what my father had been envisioning all those years ago when words had failed him. Not necessarily this scene, but something equally capable of provoking such wonder. Again? Amy pushed a button, and, our faces bathed in the glow of the screen, we watched the future a second time. This is another news story, and it's called See You Again Yesterday. I've never been one of those Americans who pepper their conversation with French phrases and entertain guests with brie plates. France was never a specific premeditated goal. For me, it was just an accident. I wound up in Normandy the same way my mother wound up in North Carolina. You meet a guy, relinquish a tiny bit of control, and the next thing you know, you're eating a different part of the pig. Had I met some other guy, I might have wound up in Turkey or Florida, though I can't imagine the level of commitment that might lead one to Yozgat, let alone Daytona Beach. Accidents happen. Things come up. But there's a lot to be said for choosing the right guy. I met Hugh through a mutual friend. She and I were painting an apartment, and he had offered the use of his 12-foot ladder. Owning a 12-foot ladder in New York is a definite sign of success, as it means you probably have some place to store it. At the time, Hugh was living in a loft on Canal Street, a former chocolate factory where the walk-in coolers served as bedrooms. I arrived at his place on a Friday night and noticed the pie baking in the oven. While the rest of Manhattan had spent their evening dressing to go out, he'd stayed home to peel apples and listen to country music. Like me, he was single, which came as no great surprise, seeing as he spent his leisure time rolling out dough and crying to George Jones albums. I had just moved to New York and was wondering if I was going to be alone for the rest of my life. Part of the problem was that, according to several reliable sources, I tend to exhaust people. Another part of the problem had to do with my long list of standards. Potential boyfriends could not smoke Merit brand cigarettes, own or wear a pair of cowboy boots, or use margarine instead of butter. Speech was important, and disqualifying phrases included, "I can't find my nipple ring," and "this here was my first tattoo." All street names had to be said in full, meaning no 59th and Lex, and definitely no Mad Ave. They couldn't drink more than I did, couldn't write poetry on notebook paper and read it out loud to strangers, and couldn't use the words flick, freebie, fest, Mickey D's, or zeitgeist. They could not consider the human scalp an appropriate palette for self-expression, could not own a rainbow-striped flag, and could not say they had discovered any shop or restaurant currently listed in the phone book.
Age, race, and weight were unimportant. In terms of mutual interests, I figured we could spend the rest of our lives discussing how much we hated the aforementioned characteristics. Hugh had moved to New York after spending 6 years in France. I asked a few questions, rightly sensing that he probably wouldn't offer anything unless provoked. There was, he said, a house in Normandy. This was most likely followed by a qualifier, something pivotal like, but it's a dump. He probably described it in detail, but by this point, I was only half listening. Instead, I'd begun to imagine my life in a foreign country. Some spot where, if things went wrong, I could always blame somebody else, saying, I never wanted to live here in the first place. Things might be difficult, yet I'd stay. I'd tough it out because living in a foreign country is one of those things that everyone should do at some point in his or her life. My understanding was that it completed a person, sanding down the rough provincial edges and transforming you into a citizen of the world. I didn't see this as a romantic idea. It had nothing to do with France itself, with wearing hats or writing tortured letters from a sidewalk cafe. You have to be a patriot to be an expatriate, and a pat to be an expat. I didn't care where Hemingway drank or Alice B. Toklas had her mustache trimmed. What I found appealing in life abroad was the inevitable sense of helplessness and the work involved in overcoming that helplessness. There would be a goal involved, and I like having goals. Built in around 1780, a 2-hour train ride from Paris, the neighbor keeps his horses in my backyard, pies made from apples from my own tree. I caught the highlights of Hugh's broadcast and understood that my first goal was to make him my boyfriend, to trick or blackmail him into making some sort of a commitment. It sounds calculating, I know, but if you're not cute, you might as well be clever. In order to get the things I want, it helps me to pretend I'm a figure in a daytime drama, a schemer. Soap opera characters make emphatic pronouncements. They ball up their fists and state their goals out loud. I will destroy Buchanan Enterprises, they say. Phoebe Wallingford will pay for what she's done to our family. Walking home with the back half of the 12-foot ladder, I turned to look in the direction of Hugh's loft. You will be mine, I said. 9 months after I'd borrowed the ladder, Hugh left the chocolate factory and we moved in together. As was his habit, he'd planned to spend the month of August in Normandy, seeing friends and working on his house. I'd planned to join him, but that first year, when the time came to buy my ticket, I chickened out, realizing that I was afraid of France. My fear had nothing to do with actual French people. I didn't know any actual French people. What scared me was the idea of French people I'd gotten from movies and situation comedies. When somebody makes a spectacular ass of himself, it's always in the French restaurant. Never the Chinese or Mexican, but always the French. They're the people who slap one another with gloves. My understanding was that no matter how hard we tried, the French would never like us. And that's confusing to an American raised to believe that the people of other countries should be grateful for all of the wonderful things that we've done. Things like, well, lots of things. Things like movies that stereotype the people of Europe as boors and petty snobs. And little remarks such as, we saved your ass in World War II. We're led to believe that people should like us because we're new and big and sure of ourselves, and isn't that reason enough? Every day we're told that we live in the greatest country on earth, and it's always stated as an undeniable fact. Leos were born between July 23rd and August 22nd. Fitted queen-size sheets measure 60 by 80 inches, and America is the greatest country on earth. Having grown up with this in our ears, it's startling to realize that other countries have nationalistic slogans of their own, none of which are, we are number two. The French have decided to ignore our self-proclaimed superiority, and that is translated as arrogance. To my knowledge, they've never said that they're better than us. They've just never said that we're the best. Big deal. There are plenty of places on Earth where visiting Americans are greeted with great enthusiasm. Unfortunately, these places tend to lack cash registers and anything you'd ever really want to buy. And that, to me, is the only reason to leave home in the first place, to buy things. He bought me great gifts the summer I stayed home and he went off to France. He's really not that much of a shopper, and I figured that if he'd managed to find these things, they must have been right out in the open where anyone could have spotted them. As far as I was concerned, the French people could be cold or even openly hostile. They could burn my flag or pelt me with stones, but if there were taxidermied kittens to be had, then I would go and bring them back to this, the greatest country on earth. There was the shopping, and then there was the smoking. He returned from his trip, and days later, I still sounded like a red Chinese asking questions about the democratic hinterlands. And you actually saw people smoking in restaurants? Really? And offices, too? Oh, tell me again about the ashtrays in the hospital waiting room. And don't leave anything out. I went to France the following summer, knowing only the word for bottleneck. I said bottleneck at the airport, bottleneck on the train to Normandy, and bottleneck when presented with the pile of stones that was Hugh's house in the country. There was no running water, no electricity, and nothing to buy but the pipes and wires needed if you wanted to live with running water and electricity. Because there was nothing to buy, the people greeted me with great enthusiasm. It would be the same if a French person were to visit, say, Knightdale, North Carolina. My goodness, everyone said, you came all this way to see us. Had my vocabulary been larger, I might have said, well, no, not exactly. Times being what they were, I offered my only possible answer. Oh, bottleneck, everyone said. You speak very well. These were nothing like the French people I had imagined. If anything, they were too kind, too generous, too knowledgeable in the fields of plumbing and electricity. The house is located in a tiny hamlet, a Hooterville of 8 stone houses, huddled in a knot and surrounded by rolling hills. There are no cash registers, but a mile away, in the neighboring village, there's a butcher, a bakery, a post office, a hardware store, and a small grocery. There's a church and a payphone, an elementary school, and a place to buy cigarettes. New York City, the shopkeeper said. Well, you're far from home, aren't you? They said this as if I'd left Manhattan for a short walk and had lost track of the time. It seemed that if you had to be from America, New York was as good a place as any. People had heard of it, especially the 3 village teenagers who studied English in high school and often dropped by to discuss life in what they called Nye. I tried to explain that the N and the Y were initials that stood for New and York, but still they insisted in joining the letters into a single word. Nye, they said, was what the insiders called it. Didn't everyone in USA use that word? They were under the impression that New York was a glittering paradise. A celebrity playground where you couldn't leave the house without running into Madonna and Michael Jackson, sitting in the park and breastfeeding their babies. I stupidly mentioned a few of the stars I'd seen in my neighborhood, and for the rest of the summer, if describing our house, you'd say, it's a place with all the teenagers lying out front. They stretched out in the middle of the road, flat on their backs, not wanting to miss anything should one of my celebrity friends decide to drop by and help me dig the septic tank. I worried that one of them might get hit by a car and that I would be blamed for the death. Oh, don't worry, the neighbors said. They'll grow out of it in a few years. This is what I'm assuming, they said. Without Hugh by my side to translate, every interaction was based upon a series of assumptions. The kind butcher may not have been kind at all, and the grocer might have been saying, to hell with you and your bottleneck. Their personalities were entirely my own invention. On the downside, my personality was entirely their invention. I seem to have reached my mid-30s only to be known as the guy who says bottleneck, the Pied Piper who convinces teenagers to lie in the road, the grown man who ignores the electric fence warnings and frightens the horses with his screaming.